Roll, and the chair will be here shortly. I'm just getting the ball rolling, so.
Representative Hughes?
Here.
Representative Isaacson?
Here.
Representative Keller?
Here.
Representative Millett? Representative Price Hopkins? Representative Gaddis?
Here.
Chair Lynn?
Okay, we're going to start with SB 206, then we go to HB 356. And lastly today is, what is it? A resolution, a third one. Anyway, we'll get there.
SJR 26, which is right here.
And Representative Millett is excused. Yeah, SJR 26, there we go. So if we would, sponsor, come up and your representative or your staff, if you'd like. And we have online, we have... the Division of Motor Vehicles, several people, and in the room we have Amy from Division, and we also have one person who wants to testify at this point, Barbara from Teamsters. So just to let you know what we have in front of us, go ahead and identify yourself for the record and tell us about SB 206, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Peter Machicki, Senator for District O.
I'm Larry Simmons, staff to Senator Machicki.
And I want to thank you and members of State Affairs for hearing this bill this morning. This bill's about three things, Mr. Chairman. It's about DMV departmental and customer efficiency. It's about efficient and timely accident reporting on our highways. And it's about having folks with appropriate backgrounds being entrusted to transport our children to school. So I kind of have this vision of the DMV, and I know those three initials bring good things to mind and to your hearts, right? Well, the DMV that I have envisioned is one that is largely most of the businesses online. So you would set up your account. Most of us as Alaskans have, you know, cars and trucks and trailers and snow machines and motorcycles and things. And you'd be able to go online and set it up much like your bill pay account and click on the registrations you wanted to renew and drag them over to your shopping cart and pay with PayPal or Visa. It's about efficiency. It's about running a business, you know, sort of like how every other business is run. The other thing that this does now, it allows them to use technology more efficiently, which they do somewhat now, but the statutes need to be updated to facilitate further improvements. And I believe that would reduce costs in the department fairly significantly once it's all in place. It also allows the department to use mail for notification or email for notification as opposed to snail mail. It puts into statute the current practice of waiving the $10 fee for processing payments using the website. It also allows the accident reports to be submitted electronically. So if you think about a serious accident out on the Glen or one of those other more remote highways, they can email in a report for immediate reporting. The other thing that it does that I think is the reason I'm pushing for it to get past this session is it changes the licensing requirements for school bus drivers. So remember, in this bill, we're only talking about school bus driver licenses, no one else's licenses, okay? But you would be surprised the crimes that are currently allowed for a school bus driver to have in their past, such as murder, assault, kidnapping, indecent exposure, felony prostitution. Today, those crimes are not prohibited as folks that put your dear little 8-year-old on a bus and maybe the last kid on that bus after a long drive down a quiet road. So this bill fixes that. Gives 10 years for a look back for existing school bus license holders. It requires a background check every 5 years at renewal. And it kind of has some common sense things about it. It gives the department discretion for licensing of a person convicted of a misdemeanor within the prior 2 years if the crime didn't involve a child. So I like the common sense aspect of it. I really like the efficiency part of what we talked about on online management. So as opposed to just thinking about your home, think about your business. If you're a fleet manager that has 100 pieces of rolling stock, being able to, as opposed to there being just a position in your company that manages that rolling stock, now it would be just something someone could do online in a couple of hours a year. So I'm excited about the bill. I hope you can support it. And we have Andy Mills and with the DOA here and Amy Erickson with DMV here for questions as well.
Questions, Representative Hughes?
Thank you for a sensible bill. I do have one question. If the notice of registration is sent by email and people change their email addresses and those kind of things, I'm just concerned, and sometimes I get a little behind, have various email accounts. I'm just concerned, would there be any kind of backup as far as it being mailed? If it were about, would a person be selecting that? I know with some of our other bills that we get to choose whether we want it snail mailed or emailed. Would that be up to the individual, or would if DMV has it, an email, that's what it would use?
So that's a very good question. But remember, I'm just setting it up so that it can legally be accomplished. I'm not, my job's not to work the details. That's for folks like Amy and her department to do those things. So my experience with this sort of thing is that they don't just have one way to deal with them. You're still going to make sure that people are notified. So in my view, you would click a box that says, I want to receive my, just like on Alaska Airlines, you say, I want to receive my notifications by email, and periodically you go in and update your email address. Well, you don't suddenly start missing your flights because you've changed your email address. You kind of manage that. I mean, there's still some, just like if you moved and you no longer had the same mailing address, you're going to kind of manage those changes. So I don't think it would be a problem. But.
Follow up?
Thank you, and I'm all for that. I try to go as paperless as possible. I just know sometimes spam filters catch things and then you don't see them. So we'll let the DMV folks let us know how they'd handle that. I just want to make sure Alaskans aren't paying a penalty or something because they didn't get it or receive it. Paid. Thank you.
Sure.
Okay.
Before we go to other questions from the committee, let's make sure we have, for the record, the right version in front of us.
Oh, so you want it moved?
Sure.
Mr. Chair,
yeah.
I would like to move version 28-LS1531/C as our working version.
Thank you. Seeing no objection, that's what's in front of us. A question for you. You made a comment that this only applies to school bus driver's license. Okay. That helps because that includes section 8. I guess the whole section. Okay, that helps to understand that.
Yeah, I mean, part of the electronic thing would be the ability to renew your licenses online for driver's license, but the entire part that talks about the criminal aspect is related only to school bus drivers.
Okay. So Section 8 does apply to other than school bus. Yeah, and so, yeah, just wanted a clarification for me. When I saw the, just for full exposure here, when I saw the 69 years, I thought, I'm getting close. I wonder if that's a realistic number. You know? And then I thought, well, then I saw it's for the eye test. And so then I guess that's.
Section 8 is a normal driver's license. The aspects that talks about the crimes are only related to.
Yes, okay.
Because we had folks that had fears about CDLs and other things. It's talking about school bus drivers.
Okay.
And Mr. Chair.
Representative Isaacson.
So Section 3 starts with the school bus drivers.
Right.
So I had to double-check that, too, because I was wondering what was going on. So to the sponsor, thank you, Senator, for making these improvements. I see that you've been exhaustive, it appears, in making sure every reference to transactions with DMV are now electronic. Is that correct?
Can be.
You left some out.
Can be.
Can be. Yeah. Are any left out?
I don't believe so, but we have Amy Erickson here. I mean, there's some things that you have to physically, I would assume, if you purchase a new vehicle, your initial would have to be on site, but we'll wait for Amy for those questions.
All right. I'll wait also on this other one regarding the police reports. So thank you for bringing this forward.
Sure.
We have testimony from Barbara from Teamsters. Would you like to make a comment on the collective before you go, Mr. Sponsor, on the collective bargaining concerns related to school bus drivers, if they have any?
Well, we had, I thought we had discussed all of those issues, so I'm happy to hear what those concerns are.
Okay. any other questions for the sponsor? Seeing none, we'll go ahead and go to public testimony. And so, Barbara, you're the, and again, we have, you know, DMV here. We'll, they're here for questions. So if you have a question for them, we'll bring them up. Otherwise, I won't.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Thank you for allowing me to speak regarding CS for Senate Bill 206 this morning. For the record, my name is Barbara Huff-Teknes. I'm the director of Teamsters Local 959 Legislative Governmental Affairs, and I'm here to speak actually in favor of this bill and to assure the committee members that the hundreds of school bus drivers that we represent around the state, I trust because of the due diligence of DMV, currently they do get background checks, and we believe for the most part that we have very safe bus drivers out in the field that do not possess some of these criminal records, but definitely we support cleaning up that effort. I actually came to before the committee today. I have had some discussion with the bill sponsor staff and also with the director of DMV, Amy Erickson, regarding page 5 of the bill. It's actually a continuation of section 7, line 3. To make it clear, though, the sentence reads, a person may renew a license under this section within 1 year before its expiration upon proper application, payment of the required fee, and the completion of a background check under B4 of this section. This is new language. I have talked with DMV, at least our understanding on it, and I want to have this discussion on the record. Whether it needs, the language needs to be clarified, the verbiage changed. As we understand, the current practice shall continue to apply. Bus driver goes to DMV, applies for a license in conjunction with their CDL. There is a background check that is conducted by the state of Alaska prior to them actually, once they actually apply for a job, maybe starting back. They go apply either through a school district or through the contractor of one of the school districts, which is a more common practice with the exception of the Anchorage School District. Upon being awarded the job, then they go through the DMV licensure process. Through that, there is a background check that is conducted by the state of Alaska. In addition to that, there is also a federal background check. Unfortunately, the feds aren't quite as quick as our DMV state local, and I guess I commend the state process. Unfortunately, we don't have a lot of control over the federal, and the question that I'm posing or concern, and for the record, is that the current practice, they get the background check, they're good to go through the state, and the practice is unless the federal comes back and shows something that the state was not able to pick up. They actually do start driving, and if there is a problem with the federal, then they're actually terminated off the job. So we had some concerns. It's very, very difficult. Actually hiring, and then once you hire, retaining bus drivers to begin with. A lot of that has to do mainly with the number of hours that they're able to work, the unusual hours that they work, and for the most part, they work 9 months a year. So we want to make sure that we're not complicating. We support all the other changes in the bill, but want to make sure that we don't complicate what's already a rather difficult situation as far as being able to hire bus drivers, because if they are awarded and then they have to wait 6 months, they're probably going to be looking for other employment. So anyway.
So, Mr. Chair.
Representative Isaacson.
Thank you. Thank you, Barbara. So just to clarify, what you're saying is that if an applicant has passed the state system, then you're reasonably confident that they'll probably pass the national?
That, well, let me restate for the record. That's actually not our concern is that based on the passage of this bill, the employee is or the applicant is told, until we receive your federal background check, you do not go to work. And that has not been the practice. Our concern or non-concern about the what comes back, it's more, does this negatively impact the current practice with respect to once they've actually been cleared through the state background check, and those new provisions that they will be checked for will be included in that, then they are actually awarded the job pending anything negative coming from the federal background check.
So, Mr. Chair.
Representative Isaacson.
Thank you. So, I'm just trying to understand, because I was reading along with you to see what they do, plus these things that we've done, and I appreciate the fact that you're putting people to work and you don't want to lose a good driver. But what happens if, I heard you say, it may be 6 months before the national check comes back, and that's three quarters of the school year? What if somebody is found to have been on the national registry for some heinous action that we would not have wanted them to drive? I mean, how? Maybe that's not the normal, but on the other hand, with people who are looking for work, that's maybe a good place to hide, unless the word goes out you will be found or something. I mean, how do you account
for
that?
We're sitting before you today. I mean, seriously, it's a question, I think, that, and I don't know how we speed up the federal process. I've been told it takes anywhere from a month to in upwards of 6 months, and I don't know that. Possibly the director of DMV might be able to answer those questions, but it's a concern that we have.
Thank you.
I think your point's well taken as well.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So what I hear you say is that if you take a state test, background check, and you come out clear, you're hired, and you could go 6 months, and this is what we're doing right now, 6 months, and find something on your record, then certainly I would hope that the school districts have part of the contract, DMV, et cetera, and I'm hoping to hear from the bill sponsor to hear his point of view on how that applies to his bill. But I mean, if you don't know the information, you do your best with what you have. When you find out the information, and it's information that you would not have hired, and it's a fireable, then you get rid of them. And so what I hope I'm hearing the Teamsters say is that you support getting rid of somebody when you find that the federal background check comes out with information that we would not have hired somebody in the first place. And I certainly would not want to have a school district not be able to let that employee go based on that new information that they received.
Through the chair, Representative Gutis, I think it's an excellent point, and we absolutely support the current practice, which is if there is a negative that comes back in the federal, they are immediately terminated. And we are not looking at changing that practice at all. We respect and we encourage good bus drivers. We think the job that they do with anywhere from 60 to 85 kids in their backside, not standing in front of them, it's a tough job. And we want to make sure that the best qualified folks are driving those buses. They are the... They're, in essence, the individuals that do assure that they make it, those kids make it safe and sound to our public school systems.
Follow-up, Representative Gutis.
I guess I don't have any follow-up except paraphrase again. So what I'm hearing you say is hire people based on what good background checks. If something bad comes out from the feds, then we get rid of them.
Absolutely.
Just for what it's worth on this issue, our options are really limited. Barbara said that a couple times. We can't put in the bill to the feds to hurry up. And I would personally really resist us giving the federal government precedence over what we do for several reasons. One is we have a good system and it works, and we have a responsibility to make sure it works. And I appreciate you pointing it out and put it on the record, but I see as far as legislature is concerned, there's little we can do with it. So, thanks.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, what's the committee? Let's hurry up and vote before. No.
Can we hear from the director?
Is there anybody? Oh, sure. Come on up.
Good morning. For the record, Amy Erickson, Director of the Division of Motor Vehicles. I do believe that Ms. Huff-Tuckness is correct that DMV accepts the application. We take the check for a background check. We submit the fingerprints and go through, and then there's a review of the applications. And at that time of review, the fingerprint cards are sent to DPS, and indeed it does take 30 to 60 days until we hear back from them. And the process has been and will continue to be that if the background check comes back with anything on the record, that we send immediate cancellation.
For the Representative Isaacson.
Thank you. So to the question about the extensiveness of the state background check, how much of what you look might mirror the results of a national search? For example, you know, you can check certain databases, but do you? Megan's Law, for example, you go online and, you know, you search that just like maybe other national databases, but
through the chair, Representative Isaacson, I'm not certain what is involved in a state background check versus a national. What I do know is that whatever comes back to us, we review it for the disqualifying offenses.
So follow up,
Representative Isaacson. Follow up.
So who do you submit? I notice you take the applicant's fingerprints, et cetera, and you submit it under AS 1262-160 for criminal justice information. Do you send that then to the troopers?
Through the chair, Representative Isaacson, yes, we do.
Okay.
Department of Public Safety.
All right. So then, Mr. Chair, I suggest that perhaps we would have in our investigations, and the only way to confirm this, but from what my knowledge is, much of the information that the national criminal background check would cover might also be covered in a more expedited way by the troopers. That's not extensive. There's certain gaps, but I think there's a lot of overlap.
Representative Isaacson, that is a question that is going to be left unsatisfactorily answered if we want to move this bill. And that's fine. And I don't think because there has been no indication of a problem in this area, I'm comfortable with that.
And my
Representative Isaacson, did you have a response?
Yes, Mr. Chair. That's more of a statement.
Okay. Good. Thank you. Anything further for the director? Representative Hughes.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Amy, if you could just tell us how you think you might roll out as far as the electronic and whether people will be choosing that, or whether if you have their email, that will be the only way you send it. And
through the chair, Representative Hughes, what we do envision is for a customer to be able to opt in if they want to start receiving their renewal notices by email, and otherwise we won't. We'll continue to send them out by mail. We do, by statute, everyone has to update their address when they change addresses, and it's a good question whether we should require that of the email address as well, if that's going to be the form of communication from there forward.
I think thank you. I think an update on email addresses is maybe even more important than physical addresses sometimes. Thank you.
Representative Gaddis? But just for the record, for clarification, the chair has joined us. He told me to go ahead and continue because he's, of course, hadn't been here for the discussion, so we'll press on.
But thank you very much.
Okay. Representative Gaddis.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And not that I would by any way tell you how to do your business, but I might have more than one or two vehicles, and I would certainly hope, because the paper parts have slipped through the mail. I mean, I've ended up having to go to the tags and titles and those, and I'm glad that they exist. But I would love to be able to go online and either click my name, click my whatever, and be able to pull up all of my trailers and all of my vehicles. And quite frankly, I'd love to be able to look and see which ones are past. I'm like, you know, my snow machine trailer, which I don't use much when I'm down here, you know, is probably past due, but then I haven't used it. But it would be really nice to see which ones I owe on. So I'm not sure how the whole process is, but from a customer standpoint, I'd really like to click my name and all the titles under my name to see how they all show up. So, you know, as you progress through it, keep that in mind. Thank you.
And, Mr. Chair, to that point.
Representative Isaacson.
I want to commend you, Amy, for what the department has done with that. I was needing to, I guess I had a delinquent vehicle registration. And I thought, oh, my goodness, how am I going to get this thing registered? And I remembered the online version. I just registered another of my vehicles. And all I had to do, it was very simple, that asked me for maybe the last four of my VIN number or something, and boom, it was right there, got it done, less than 10 minutes. I was afraid. I thought, man, I'm going to have to sit on the phone for a long time, figure all this out. I commend you for the electronic system that's evolving. It's becoming very good.
Thank you. We're actually very excited. We have borrowed a webmaster from the Department of Administration, and so we're really trying to spruce up our website and make it even easier for customers.
Thank you.
So, seeing no other questions, we're going to close public testimony. I think we have exhausted it. That brings it before the committee for action. Or discussion, or whatever. Representative Gaddis?
Mr. Chair, I think this is a relatively, I don't want to jinx it and say simple or easy bill, but really, it is truly a cleanup bill that probably should have been done years ago, and with technology and what we have now, and I'm loving where DMV is going with this, and I'd like to move this bill out of committee.
Please do.
Oh, hi.
That's what I was waiting for.
Mr. Chair, I move, let me see, working draft, I guess that's what we'll call it, 28-LS1531/C from committee with individual recommendations and accompanying fiscal notes.
Seeing no objection, the bill moves, and we're going to take an at ease, and I'll pass the gavel back here to the chair, and there's going to be a little bit of a break as we set up for the next bill from Representative Seaton one little time. So.
The House State Affairs Committee will please come back to order. I'd like to thank Vice Chair Wes Keller for filling in on that first bill, and I guess it went okay. We passed the bill.
Yeah.
Because it was a good one. Okay, please introduce yourself and the bill and tell us what we got going here.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It's a pleasure to be back before State Affairs. I'm Representative Paul Seaton. I represent Homer in the Southern Kenai Peninsula.
And we miss you on this committee, by the way.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. House Bill 356 requires a commissioner of the Department of Administration to implement procedures for decreasing the incidence of disease in Alaska in order to hold down the inflation of health care costs. This bill focuses on preventing the incidence of disease as opposed to treatment of disease. And this bill creates an advisory committee on wellness, which is charged with making recommendations to the commissioner of administration, and HB 356 will enforce a paradigm shift for the Department of Administration. It will require agencies to implement policies in Alaska to keep Alaska employees and their dependents healthy by preventing disease. And Mr. Chairman, if I could make a short
yes, please.
PowerPoint presentation. And let me explain as we go into this. This is purely an example of something that might come from the Health and Wellness Committee that would enable us to lower those costs.
So, please proceed.
Thank you. And what we're looking at in here is we have a $3.8 billion unfunded liability in our PERS and TERS directly related to the increase of health care costs beyond what was originally estimated in 2002. In other words, we estimated that long term we would have health care escalation at 2%, and now it's anywhere between 4% and 6%. And so there's so that's what we're trying to do with the that's the easiest to see in the retirees. So here we have 17,000 active employees and their dependents, and we have about 64,000 retirees and dependents. And you can see we're, you know, $600 million a year in our spend. And how we spend that money, you can see at $1.6 billion is on from government employers. And so we're looking at that portion in this bill. We're not saying that we're doing something across the entire population of the state. We're talking about those in which we have a contractual relationship with. And so how do we spend that money? 30-plus percent goes to health, hospital care, and 28 to doctors, clinical services. So if we can avoid hospital services and avoid doctor and clinical services by prevention of disease, we get to the crux of the problem. And currently what we do is we look at insurance focuses mainly on one thing, and that is limitations on either coverage or limitations on compensation to doctors. The Department of Labor works on prevention by having limitation on length of day, time of day, or other safe working conditions. The Department of Health and Social Services mainly focuses through voluntary childhood vaccination programs as their primary prevention, as well as looking at some voluntary lifestyle changes and prescription drug safety. DEC, you know, we have programs to look at PSP or paralytic shellfish poison testing, pasteurized milk, restaurant and food inspections to try and keep our people healthy. But prevention of disease is pretty much limited to this, and the Department of Safety looking at illegal drugs and, you know, and smoking in close public places and those things. So, Mr. Chairman, what we're looking at is how can we avoid diseases and prevent illness instead of just paying for sick care. And so these following slides are looking at what we could do at, in just one little category, and what the economic impact of that would be. So here's our active plan members and all the percentage of the different kinds of issues. And in this case, we're talking about vitamin D. And you see these checks over here at the side. This is referring to all of these conditions that are related to vitamin D deficiency, of which it's prevalent in Alaska within our employee workforce and our retiree workforce. And here's the same chart on retirees. And you can see down here we're talking about 61%. It was 66% directly related illnesses in the active workforce. So we're talking about a huge number of things that could be addressed. So let's just take a look at a few of those. One would be a meta-analysis of breast cancer risk. And a meta-analysis is a combination of a number of studies. And just so we're all clear about how we're reading this slide, this is looking at all those people, and they're put into fists, or quintiles it is. This is the bottom 20%, the next 20% of the population, and so forth to the upper 20% of the population. And as you can see, those with the higher, above 52 in this look at breast cancer, they have 50% of the risk of those that are in the lowest 20% of the population in relation to breast cancer. So the question is, which of these groups do we want our healthcare, our active and our retiree populations to be in? And you can see, just for information, 21 nanograms per milliliter is the average of the U.S. population. Now, Alaska has generally much lower because, of course, vitamin D is made through summertime exposure of the skin. During the winter, the angle of the sun is so low that all of the ultraviolet B is absorbed coming through the atmosphere. So for 7 months out of the year in Alaska, you can be out in the sunshine and not make any vitamin D, because the low energy rays that make vitamin D convert the oils in your skin to vitamin D, don't get through the atmosphere from that low sun angle. That's the same thing as morning sun and afternoon sun. You can't make any. So looking at that, you can see there's a 50% reduction, and what does that mean? That would mean that if we had the 50% reduction in our population, we would save $3 million plus per year just in the breast cancer costs within the active employee and retiree employee and their dependents that are insured through us, we would save $3 million a year. Let's look at another condition. This is another meta-analysis looking at colorectal cancer. And again, breast cancer and colorectal cancer are two big cost drivers in Alaska. And again, we see the same thing on this meta-analysis, and you can see that the lowest quintile here, lowest 20% compared to the upper 20%, and somewhere around 34 in these studies, you got to the 50% reduction in colorectal cancer. Again, the question is, do we want to take actions to encourage people to be in this range, 50% less colorectal cancer, or do we want to not have any policies at all, which is our current program on this? And again, it's about $2 million a year we would save if we just reach that 50% level. One of the big things that we've been looking at is type 2 diabetes. And here's a clinical trial that's been going on for several years now. And if we look at that closely, the average U.S. population has 8.5 people per 1,000 per year will be diagnosed with type 2 diabetes. In this clinical trial, there were 2,200 people that got their vitamin D levels up to an average of 48, and it went to less than 1, a 90% reduction in the incidence of type 2 diabetes with just raising vitamin D levels from the average 21 to 48. And that costs about $10 a year, by the way, per person. And what would that savings be? That savings would be about $4.3 million a year we would save by that kind of action. Here is, you know, we do have pregnancies in the active workforce and their dependents. And this is looking at the March of Dimes has a project for the United States trying to get preterm births down to 9.6%. And the reason is preterm births are really expensive and they have bad health consequences. And so in South Carolina, they've had this program going on, and with just vitamin D, they were able to lower that to 7%, 2% below the national goal of March of Dimes for 2020. And so that's a 32% reduction in the number of preterm births. And for every 25 preterm births avoided, that saves about $1.3 million. So we're looking at diseases there, but there's many things that are much more prevalent. And that this is a great one. This is a Canadian study that just came out. And they looked at in Canadian children what happens if you look at those that have above 30 nanogram per milliliter compared to those that had 20, and there's a 70% reduction in upper respiratory tract infections at tuberculosis, pneumonia, bronchitis, influenza, and colds. So the significant drivers in our population. Just two more things we want to look at. One is inflammation. This happens to be an inflammatory gum disease because you can see it and doctors test it. This was a study that just came out of India in 2013, and you see the placebo. There was no change in 90 days with 2,000 IU of vitamin D that got people up to around 80% reduction in inflammation. Gum disease, tooth loss is one thing. But remember that when your body is not able to fight inflammation, you're also talking about inflammation is what starts and accentuates hardening of the arteries. And that's why gum disease is also related to heart disease. You know, it's the same kind of procedure. And so that's what the bill we have. And the bill is really doing one thing. To the greatest extent legally and reasonably practical, we're asking the Department of Administration to hold the escalation of health care costs down by administering policies in our group insurance to as low as possible, and also to institute or implement the recommendations of the Advisory Committee on Wellness, which is what this bill establishes. Mr. Chairman, the whole goal of this is just showing an example of something we could be doing. I presume that the Committee on Wellness would look at this data, which we've looked at quite a bit, and said, oh, could we hold the incidence of disease in Alaska down, and would that save us money? It would definitely save us money if we can hold incidence of disease down, because although we have a group health policy, most of our backup is self-insurance. The state of Alaska is self-insured, so every dollar that we save is a savings to the state of Alaska. The bill that establishes this has a minimum of 7 members. The Department of Administration selects those members. When they had a voluntary advisory committee, which they do now, previously what they did was they had over 90 people apply to be on it. This is a non-paid position, but people, members of our employment workforce, do want to save health care, do want to save the issues of health and the pain and suffering that comes to the families. So the big thing that is done in this bill, it uses the model of the Citizens Advisory Committee that is for the looking at child in need of aid, and so this uses that same model that requires the department to answer and to tell us how within 6 months they're trying to implement or whether they're implementing certain programs or how they're doing. And so what this does is gives more of a push and more authority for the recommendations of the Wellness Committee to be heard. It's all within the Department of Administration. It's free positions. They can participate telephonically to those meetings, so it doesn't require travel. And so, Mr. Chairman, I would just like to say that trying to move our state forward in our budget crunches to try and hold down the escalation of costs, to try to remove some of the unfunded liability in our retiree systems, I think are all good things. And I just want to again say that this was just an example of one of the things that a wellness committee would delve in depth to and look at. There are other things as well. Often we focus only on those that are really hard to do, changing lifestyle, losing 30 pounds or 40 pounds of weight. Those are really hard things to do. Some other things that the Wellness Committee would look at could be much more easily accomplished. And so thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much. Any questions from the committee? Vice Chair Keller.
I've heard the bill before. Thank you, Representative Seaton, for bringing it forward. I got to apologize on the record. I'm going to propose that we make a conceptual amendment on the fly here, and therefore I'd like to get your feedback on what you think of this. I tell you, first of all, that I really commend your focus on prevention and wellness. And having been involved in the Alaska Healthcare Commission and several other task forces related to prevention and wellness, I've got quite a bit of time meeting people that really have share the same passion that Representative Seaton has. The problem that I'm struggling with is in the intent language, starting in page 1, line 9 through page 2, line 1. I'm going to propose deleting subsection 2, 3, and 4, and I'm going to go through it and explain why. When it says the state is not adequate,
would you give the where you are again?
Page 1, okay. Line 9.
Okay, go ahead.
And the first thing is there: the state has not adequately focused on state policy on avoiding disease and maintaining a good health in the state's population. I would propose that that may be true, but I would think it would be better stated if we said the state could do more, because the state has focused on state policy on avoiding disease and maintaining good health. So when we put this intent statement in there, what we're doing in effect is we're really, what do I want to say, in the face of those that I know are very passionate and going through it. And then sub three, it says the state relies on federal one-size-fits-all human health policy recommendations. If I were to fix that, I would say the state relies completely or in part on federal policy recommendations, because there's been a lot of policy recommendations from the state that have been very positive and have been applied. You know, so it implies here that that's the only thing that the state policy is based on is federal, and I don't think that's true. Yeah, I really don't. And then sub four, when we get down to that, in line 13, the state's human health policy have not incorporated peer-reviewed scientific studies, and I would argue that it certainly has at some degree. It may not have enough, but it certainly uses peer-reviewed scientific studies. I know because I have reviewed them, and I have been part of the process of making recommendations based on studies that, you know, scientific studies that are out there. In fact, that's, I got to point out, that's one of the major interests of the Health Commission, is the terminology evidence-based, and I realize that that is often on healthcare treatment versus prevention. However, the evidence-based element is very much a priority for the commission, and we have, you know, have had and seen studies, a lot of studies, scientific studies that we base our recommendations on. And I don't think it takes away at all from well, your bill if we were to take line, page 1, line 9, and delete it all the way through page 2, line 2, because it still gives the intent that it's about prevention and wellness, and the bill law itself, you know, describes what you're doing. And I want to, you have said on the record that the department is, I don't think you said they're supportive, but they're not in the way, and I, you know, not saying no. And I think that's very consistent with the philosophy that I see, you know, the more we can do for prevention, the better, you know, and this is one, that's why I will support the bill and want it to move forward. It's just that I, with all those words, I would like your response to my proposed conceptual amendment.
Thank you very much. Before you comment, Representative Isaacson?
So I'm wondering, just because we have the sponsor here and we're speaking to a possible conceptual, I like the idea of what the vice chair said about making it positive. So I'm wondering if we could keep these in here just by saying the state policy should focus more on avoiding disease, et cetera. And three, the state relies in part, as you said. And then four, the state's human health policy should always incorporate peer-reviewed science. I like four especially because I am so much on this peer review that it's open to the public and not just peer-reviewed in a back room and stamped with the idea, well, this has been peer-reviewed. No, open it to the public so everyone can see and be transparent and comment on it. So I like the idea of altering it. I wouldn't take those out. I would just make them affirmatives.
Just a very quick response.
Representative Keller.
That's fine with me. In fact, that's what I initially intended to do, and then I got looking at the clock and thinking about the fact this intent language and whatever. I'm completely open to that.
Okay. So let's get a comment from Representative Seaton on both of these proposals. Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I fully agree, and if I might make a suggestion on the fly here on line 9, if we took out has not adequately focused and inserted should focus conceptually.
Should focus state policy more on
avoiding disease and maintaining good health, if that would inserting more between policy and on as well, if that would satisfy your question. I have no problem at all in part. And then I think on number four, there's been a, you know, it's split between the pages, so we're misreading the intent of this. The intent of this is looking at the, starting on line 14, the differences between the population of this state and the population of other states. So I was not intending this to mean that we haven't looked at peer-reviewed science. I was meaning this to, so possibly we could just move on line 14 to the end of the sentence where it says differences. We could move that the state's human health policies have not incorporated differences between the population of the state and the populations of other states in considering peer-reviewed scientific studies that.
On that topic, Mr. Chair, what do you think of Representative Isaacson's suggestion of striking have not and put the word should in there?
That would be fine.
Yeah.
And Mr. Vice Chair, you want to make a conceptual?
One other one. I would like to, after the word relies on page 11, put in part, and because that isn't the federal one size fits all recommendations are not the only thing that the state relies in. So, if that's okay, so then I will move, and just to clarify, using Representative Isaacson's words here, I don't mean, but it's right here, is on page 9 then, or page 1, line 9, strike, state has not adequately focused, and insert, should focus, and then after the word policy, add the word more, so it would read
The state policy should focus more on.
The state should focus state policy more on avoiding disease and maintaining good health in the state's population.
Well, can you read that again?
The state should focus the state policy, not the, I'll start over. The state should focus state policy more on avoiding disease and maintaining good health in the state's population. And then on page 1, line 11, after the word relies, put in part, so it would read the state relies in part on federal one-size-fits-all human policy. And then on page 1, line 13, strike the words have not and insert the word should. Conceptual amendment, yeah, number
okay.
One.
Okay, you move the amendment?
Yes, I move, so move.
Good. Question, Lori?
Yes.
Your timeout. So we're back on the record? would you make whatever correction need back on the record, please?
Oh, sure, on the record. And again, this is conceptual, so the drafters will have an opportunity to move this around. But it reads a little better on line 9 if it says the state policy should focus more on avoiding disease. That would be the intent. And then on line 13, in the word incorporate, that's past tense, so the D would be gone, and it would be present tense incorporate. I think we got it.
Any comments or questions on that? Okay. So the bill passes not the bill, not yet, but the conceptual amendment passes without objection. Okay. Any other closing comments? Anybody online? Anybody in the audience?
So just one clarification.
Representative Isaacson.
Thank you. And Representative Seaton, I appreciate the fact that you're the evangelist of vitamin D. I have started taking vitamin D more. My pre-diabetic testing seems to have come down a smidge, so I'm hoping that in 90 days I'll have a good positive report. But what I was glad to hear, and I just wanted on the record that this is not a vitamin D commission, this is a wellness commission. And as you said, your intent was to show one way of approaching it, but there are others, such as the exercise, the cutting out of certain substances, moderate smoking, drinking, et cetera. That all would go into this. So when we're looking at a successful wellness programs throughout the United States, Alaska would have a group that could bring this into the discussion to the administration, and that's what your intent is. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Representative Eisenhower, that's exactly the intent. And I want to clarify that this is not taking over from the Health Care Commission. The Health Care Commission is broad across the state, looks at the entire population. This is focusing on individuals which the state has a contractual relationship where we are the insurers of those people. So we have mechanisms with the people in which we deal, whether it's in co-pays or whether it's other incentive programs, that we have actual ways of talking to them and giving incentives for changes in behavior. So it is some ways different than a broad concept of what could all Alaskans do. And so, but I'm very supportive of all the other things that the wellness committees do. I just brought this forward to the committee because it's pretty easy. And when you look at that one page that's additional in there, it shows over $10 million a year we could be saving in that. But it's not just the savings. It's the pain and suffering and the changes that have to undergo in families and disruptions and those kind of things that come along, whether it's breast cancer or colon cancer or diabetes, all of those things, if we can avoid some of those problems within that go in families with those kinds of chronic illnesses, then we would be making a great leap forward. So, but the vitamin D presentation was strictly just one aspect of what a wellness committee might consider. There's nothing in this bill that says they have to do any of that. But I appreciate all the advisory wellness committee has done.
Thank you.
Strength.
Thank you very much. Any further comment? Okay, Representative Keller.
Yeah, I want to say thank you and I apologize to the sponsor for doing that on the fly. I think, frankly, it'll knowing the people involved, you know, that the a positive approach is good. There's nobody I've ever met that is against wellness or vitamin D, you know. So, and I notice the sponsor wears belts and suspenders. So, you know, that's not a bad move here on the wellness arena. So with that, I'd like to move the bill, if I could.
Okay, go ahead and move the bill.
I'd like to move HB 356 version LS 1465 Charlie from committee with individual recommendations and attached zero fiscal amount.
Okay. Any comment or recommend?
As amended.
Thank you.
Okay. Okay. Without objection, the bill passes. Thank you for bringing this forward to us. And I was late this morning, and I did not take my vitamin D, so I'll take care of it later in the day.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee.
That is a lifestyle.
House State Affairs Committee, back on the record. We'll now be considering Senate Joint Resolution number 16 and 26. Please introduce yourself and present the bill.
My name is Reneva Moss, staffer Senator Coghill, and what you have before you is Senate Joint Resolution 26, which recognizes June 14, 2014, as the 60th anniversary of the first recital of the Pledge of Allegiance using the words "Under God." Earlier this year, 39 other states have passed resolutions that recognized February 10th as the 60th anniversary of the introduction of House Joint Resolution 243, which added the words "under God." We were a little behind time, so we have changed this resolution to reflect June 14th, which is Flag Day, by the way, as the 60th anniversary of the first recital of the Pledge of Allegiance using Under God. The original pledge was written in 1892 by a minister by the name of Francis Bellamy, and he used the pledge as a symbol to all nations to pledge allegiance to their flags as individual countries. However, by 1923, the United States has been through World War I, and they wanted to make the pledge more near and dear to Americans. So the American Legion and the Daughters of the American Revolution had the Pledge of Allegiance changed at that time to add one nation. So we pledge allegiance to one nation. And then in 1954, President Eisenhower, and in your little book here, I have actually reproduced a sermon that was written by Pastor George Dougherty's. And he gave this sermon in 1954, and President Eisenhower just happened to be at the church that day listening to the pledge. And the pastor was citing the Gettysburg Address and discussing Lincoln and Lincoln's frustration with what was missing from this country. And several times in the Gettysburg, the word under God is found. And the pastor was pressing to see what was missing in this country during a time when communism was invading the world, where 8 million people had already been killed under the realm of communism. And many times in this sermon, he used the word under God. In fact, in his closing comments, he said, "In this land, there is neither Jew nor Greek, nor bond nor free, nor male or female, for we are one nation, indivisible, under God. And humbly, as God has given us the light, we seek liberty and justice for all." That inspired President Eisenhower, and he got with a couple of congressmen from Michigan, and they both introduced in the House and the Senate a resolution that would change the Pledge of Allegiance to include under God. That was Senator Homer Ferguson and Representative Charles Oakman. Now, this gives you a brief history of the Pledge of Allegiance, but I don't think it gives you the human touch to reciting the pledge. Recognizing the history of the pledge reminds us that it has a deep, independent meaning for each and every one of us. It's not a mundane verse that we have memorized because we've recited it every day in school. It reminds us that we live in a country that doesn't persecute us because we pledge to preserve the God-given inherent rights this country was founded in. It reminds us that we are a government of 50 individual states who are united as a nation of free people. It reminds us that this flag, Old Glory, has carried through battlefields and blood has been shed by millions to protect the freedom that we have to speak our minds and disagree with each other without the threat of retaliation. It reminds us that people from all over the world come to our country at a risk to live the American dream. When I stand in the gallery at the Senate chambers and recite the Pledge of Allegiance with a room full of citizens and the senators, what I hear is a group of Americans united, indivisible, in preserving this republic and the God-given rights our forefathers strive to preserve. This resolution is yet one reminder that we are Americans united as one nation under God. The words "under God" were added to the pledge by Congress on June 14, 1954, during the Cold War, as a way to distinguish the United States from communism. On June 14, 1954, President Eisenhower signed the resolution that added words "under God" to the pledge and declared, "From this day forward, the millions of our school children will daily proclaim in every city and town, every village and rural schoolhouse, the dedication of our nation and our people to the Almighty. To anyone who truly loves America, nothing could be more inspiring than to contemplate this rededication of our youth on each school morning to our country's true meaning. I wanted to quote President Eisenhower's speech so I could end this presentation with some words I heard as a teenager that stay in my memory about the pledge. The words were spoke by a comedian in the 60s by the name of Red Skelton, and I have put in this little booklet Red Skelton's little skit on the Pledge of Allegiance. But what he said at the end of that was, since I was a small boy, two states have been added to our country, and we surely know one of those states, and two words have been added to the Pledge of Allegiance, under God. Wouldn't it be a pity if someone said that it is a prayer and be eliminated from school? And right now we have a case open that is challenging the Pledge of Allegiance and the use of under God as a prayer. And that decision will be here any day. But this resolution is a resolution that states all over the country are using to preserve history so that courts can't change history. Thank you.
Thank you very much. You know, like everybody else, going to the floor almost every day, at least at the end of session, that's really the most comforting, the Pledge of Allegiance and the invocation, the most comforting part of the day, and reminds us really, why are we here? You know, what were we elected? Why are we here? What are we trying to do here? And I think it's, you know, as I've said many times, the whole process is all messed up, but it's the best in the world, the best we'll ever have. So I very much in favor of this. I had one little question down here, but first, sure. Let me go to some. Let me give you a little bit of history, which you're much younger than I am, so you may not know this. But as you know, we stand in the morning and say, I pledge allegiance to hand over our heart. But when I first went to school, we stood hand and say, I pledge allegiance to the flag, and you hold a hand out. And of course, that was originally a Roman salute, but you're too close to the Nazi salute because that was doing, you know, World War II. And so they stopped this, and now it's only this. Did anybody else in the committee know that?
Yes,
it's in the packet.
Yeah?
Yeah, it shows in the packet.
It's in the packet.
Yeah. What's that now?
Yeah. There's a picture of that.
Oh, is there
in
the packet?
Yeah, through the chair.
Yeah. Yeah.
Representative Isaacson.
So I appreciate that little bit of history, Mr. Chair, because before you had mentioned that on the floor, of course, I'm far too young to have ever remembered that, and my parents never mentioned that. So it is a little thing. And to the sponsor and to his staff, Reneva, thank you for this this little review of history, and I hope this can be done in such a way that those who would like a copy of this, and I know that there's cameras everywhere, so, you know, they're looking at us someplace, make this available, because you go through the history, and perhaps some of it can be found online under god.procon.org, but you go through this and you see the history from the very early days to the recent lawsuits that have been brought against it, and that is very instructional. I like the quote that I read in here about Ronald Reagan saying that, you know, every native-born American needs to go to an immigration ceremony or to speak to those who have immigrated and become a citizen by choice, because he said that it would renew our vigor, our desire to preserve peace for another 200 years. And having been one who, as a mayor, has several times had the honor of going with the new citizens being sworn in, it is invigorating to hear their stories and why they desire to abandon their citizenship in another country and adopt ours. It's like, can you conceive of needing having the desire to abandon the U.S., your U.S. citizenship, and take on somebody else's? To most of us, that's a crazy thought. And yet, necessity and circumstances have driven other people to leave their homelands, whether out of adversity or just for better opportunity to, and they've seen that America as a place where their new home can be. They've renounced other citizenships and adopted ours. It has made me wonder, what am I missing? And why should I ever become complacent about my citizenship? So thank you for reminding us. Many people may think that this is just, that's just the pledge after all. And, you know, it's not important. But this helps to remind, and this discussion we've had helps to remind us how important it is, and those who have bled, fought, and died to help us understand the value of the pledge, summarizing our history and our hopes. I really appreciate this. Thank you.
You know, what you just said, I may get a transcript of that, because that was a beautiful oration you made there. I mean, most sincerely, that was very well put, and I may get a copy of that. I had a little bit of a personal experience on it. I have six kids. My second kid is Bob Lin Jr. He married a Chinese girl, Zhang Ping Li. It took her 5 years to get her citizenship, and I was honored to be in Anchorage when she did the first Pledge of Allegiance up there. So she didn't have adversity. She just found another good guy named Bob. But it's a beautiful ceremony. And I think there were two other people in the room with her. I don't know their history at all. So to see that was really uplifting. Representative Keller.
Yeah, thank you. Yesterday I had the honor of starting the session with the invocation, and it's just fascinating that this morning, I really appreciate the sponsor bringing this forward. But I just want to point out that the concept of under God goes clear back to our declaration very clearly. It talks about nature's law and nature's God, of course, in the opening statement, but it also talks about the fact that we're all created equal, implying the fact that we are, there is a creator, and that we're all endowed by our Creator with individual rights. So it talks about Creator, God, and then in the last paragraph it talks about, you know, they're making their case in the Declaration of Independence of why the United States of America should be, you know, stand up and be the rebels, you know, against Great Britain. And they appeal in the last paragraph to the Supreme Judge of the world, and that, of course, is God. And then the last statement before they signed off on the Declaration of Independence. And when they signed that document, they became criminals, you know, and they were in you know, a lot of risk. And they said, with firm reliance on divine providence, we pledge to each other our fortunes and honor. And it's a, you know, this under God idea did not come about in 1954. And I know the sponsor knows that, and I just wanted to put on the record that it's very evident in one of the very most foundational documents that we have that forms this country, and it's consistent throughout.
Thank you very much. I do on one of the whereases on page 2, line 16, and we've got... We talk about the history, bondage to our Christian heritage, and we have a very rich foundation here. We have, I think, I'd like to see more of the Judeo-Christian, because after all, where did we get Christianity? It, you know, the Bible is basically, I'm not talking about number of pages, but the Bible is basically half Judaic and half Christian. The Old Testament is Jewish. The New section is Christian, the New Testament. And so I'd like to see that changed from Christian to Judeo-Christian. Would you have any, would that be a friendly amendment if I put
Mr.
that in?
Mr. Chairman, it probably would not be a friendly amendment. Senator Coghill feels very strongly that this country was established under Christian principles, and I think he feels very strongly that it should be a Christian heritage.
Well, any comment on this discussion?
I would just like to say that I would like to honor the perspective of the sponsor.
Any other comments?
Mr. Chair. So I appreciate what you were just saying, Judeo-Christian. Definitely the heritage of Christianity flows from the similar belief in the one true God, Almighty God, creator of heaven and earth, which was affirmed in Jewish tradition, but it was even before the Jews, Adam, had that personal relationship. So you could say it's a biblical faith of which Christianity is definitely the proud banner carrier of that faith. So I think by staying as to the desires of the sponsor, we still incorporate all of that rich heritage that you also mentioned. So for that reason, I would want to honor the sponsor as well. He's also my senator. So
I don't know who is next. Representative Hughes.
Yes, I would just like, thank you, Mr. Chair. Was there actually a discussion with the sponsor about whether to use Judeo-Christian or Christian? Because to me, Judeo-Christian encompasses Christian as well, and if he specifically said he didn't want Judeo-Christian.
Through the chair, Representative Hughes, there has been several discussions about changing this, even widespread to include Muslim, and he feels very strongly that he doesn't want this to be the slippery slope. He wants it to be a Christian heritage.
If I could comment on that very specifically, the reason, I think part of the reason here, is that our government system, you know, with its checks and balances, and it really reflects the Christian heritage more so than going back and incorporating the Judeo part. And if you go back and look, it's a pretty fascinating history. There's the people in the room. You've seen that famous painting of the signers of the Declaration of Independence. When you go through their careers and job descriptions, it's pretty impressive. It was a group of, there's no doubt, it was a group of Christian folks that were there. And then the influence of Christianity on the government system that we have is profound and deep. And I concur again, staying with that.
Of course, we're not talking about the people, you know, who landed here. We're talking about the heritage. If we had the people who landed, the first folks who landed here on our shores, Plymouth Rock, you know, and so on, that would be the people. They're unquestionably non-Jewish. They were Christian. Nonetheless, they came from the heritage. Did you have a...
Sure.
Jump in here.
I wasn't going to weigh in, but I will weigh in. And I see this resolution as basically honoring and respecting the 60 years that we've said under God in our Pledge of Allegiance. And as I might respectfully talk to my colleagues and say, but I think we're getting into the weeds, if you will, in a deeper discussion than what I think that this resolution actually says. And as much as I can appreciate the conversation, my fear is that we'll get into something that is not what the bill sponsor really wanted to celebrate in these 60 years. So.
Right on. Okay. I'd like to put on the record that I would prefer the Christian heritage, but also I prefer the Judeo-Christian heritage rather than this. But I'm not on the Finance Committee, but I can count. So I will not offer an amendment on that, but my druthers would be that we had that.
And I will pass that on to Senator Coghill.
Okay. Any other comments or questions? Representative Keller.
Could I move
you may.
Senate Joint Resolution 26, version November, from committee with individual recommendations and attached zero fiscal limits.
Okay, without objection, it passes.
Thank you very much.
We will meet again on Thursday. We'll likely have, we're going to have a meeting on Thursday. And what is that bill?
I don't know the bill number yet.
I don't know the bill
number. Well, the subject.
EPA resolution. Resolution on the EPA.
Yes. Okay, yeah. I got it. Okay, so we won't meet. We'll get together one more time here. That may be at the next one, but we are adjourned.